Wendy is directing me from Virginia, how my family thinks my death should go. Why can't they let me die the way I want to die? I need to go now. How do I make myself die? Patrick and Noah are arguing. Noah says maybe there's something else they can do to buy more time. I can't hear what Patrick is saying, but I hear his tone of voice, low, loving, gentle. Patrick knows I don't want more time, not unless I can have eons of it. Marnie, that's it, that's what I will think about. I wrap her in love and light. I send her a message. Love is the only thing that matters. I want to stop the men from talking. I want to tell Patrick about her, but something says not to that Noah would hear. What a funny business love is. And these two men sitting here, one the past and one the possible future. There was so much I still wanted to do. And then I'm up on the ceiling, looking down at myself, a perfect little wrecked body there in the bed, beautiful and strange. That body of mine, so useful and brave, wrapped now in a white gown. The gown I'd picked out and made Noah help me get into. Patrick is there on the bed too, looking down at me. I feel it when he notices that I'm not there anymore. He reaches over and touches my hand, curls my fingers in his own large hand, the hand that was burned. Thank you, I say. And now it's time. So much left undone. So much I still want to feel and know. But I've already let go.
18. Marnie. I wake up in the middle of the night, startled into sitting upright in bed, noticing my heart hurts. The air feels sharp in the room, as though it has an unfamiliar smell, like a candle has burned down somewhere. I want to awaken Jeremy, just for company. It's so nice turning over at night to find somebody next to me in the bed again. Yet I don't wake him up. I lie there, longing for something I can't quite name. What woke me up? Happiness. Happiness woke me up. But there's something else. Something about life feeling so fragile. Something about love being the only thing that matters. I go to the window and look out at the blackness of the night. There's a shooting star, and I watch it, unsure whether it's really the trail of an airplane. But no, it's a star. Blazing out, probably from millions of years ago. Isn't that what they say? That when we look at the stars, we are seeing the past? 19. Marnie. The envelope is from the law firm of Brockman, Wyatt, and Sanford, and by the time it arrives at my parents' house, it looks like it has been through the worst that the postal system has to offer. I pick it up by its halfway torn and blackened corner and take it inside with the rest of the mail. It's about a million degrees outside, and I'm excited because tonight Jeremy and I are going to talk about taking a vacation together, just the two of us. He says we should rent a red convertible and drive up the coast through Georgia, go to Savannah, and up to Charleston. And, well, there is some indication that Jeremy might propose. That's what Natalie thinks, and just talking about it makes her so happy that I go along with it, even though I told her that it seems crazy somehow, even trashy, to have two marriage proposals in 1 year from two different men. She said, "It's not trashy if it means you're getting your life on the right track. And anyway, it's a great story you can tell the grandchildren when you and Jeremy are celebrating your golden wedding anniversary. The year you married two men. I think that'll be a wonderful story." I walk into the kitchen, ripping open the envelope as I go, and then I hold the letter in one hand while I open the refrigerator to get the pitcher of iced tea and then get a glass out of the cupboard. The birds are chirping madly at the feeder, probably complaining about the heat, and I stop to watch them while I'm sipping my tea. When I look down, Blix's name jumps out at me. Dear Ms. McGraw, I am writing to you because our law firm is representing the estate of Blix Marlene Holliday. Estate? Blix is dead? Oh my God, Blix is dead. I sink down onto one of my mother's kitchen chairs. I put the letter on the table and close my eyes for a moment, remembering the night of the wedding when she said that she was at the end of life and I didn't make her tell me what she meant. So long ago. I have meant to keep in touch with her. Honestly, I have meant to tell her about Jeremy and that I'm living in Jacksonville now and that I'm going to be okay and to thank her for all the good wishes about the big life and all that. But, well, I've been terrible. So much has happened to me in such a short time, and I didn't keep her filled in about any of it. But really, why would I? She was Noah's great aunt, and yes, she was kind to me, but she belonged to him. And even as I'm saying this to myself, I know it's just an excuse I'm making up because I feel so guilty. All this new life in Florida. Had she somehow known this would be where I would end up? And damn it, I never even knew that she was sick. And now she's dead. Shit. I pick up the letter again and scan it quickly. Our client, Blix Holliday, recently deceased, has named you in her last will and testament as the owner of a property belonging to her, a house on Berkeley Place in Brooklyn, New York. I drop the letter. Of course this is a mistake. It has to be. Surely Blix left it to Noah, and the post office forwarded it on to me because he's in some forsaken place in Africa with no forwarding address. Or maybe she left it to the two of us during the 20 minutes or so that we were husband and wife, and she never got around to changing her will and taking my name off. But nope. I pick up the letter and read further. I am the sole owner of the house, according to Mr. Sanford. Me, Ms. Marnie McGraw. Mr. Sanford urges me to come to Brooklyn as soon as I can. Right away would be nice, since there are decisions I need to make. Decisions. He ends the letter with, I know this may come as a surprise to you, Ms. McGraw, which was exactly what my client wished. She spoke to me many times of her great hope that you would live in Brooklyn and take care of the house. Most recently, right before she died, she urged me to impress upon you the urgency of coming to Brooklyn immediately to review the terms of the will and to participate in the pending decisions that must be made. And she asked that I assure you that your expenses would be paid in full. She wishes for you to stay in the house while you are here making arrangements. Also, I am to tell you that there are tenants living in the house who are anxious to meet you. And if you knew Blix, who was a dear personal friend, you also know that she liked to do things a certain way and have her wishes respected. Sincerely yours, Charles F. Sanford, Esquire. Holy cow. I put the letter down and rub my head. Blix is summoning me. That time she invited me and I turned her down. Now she's insisting that I come, now that it's too late. Too late to see her, that is. But why? What does she want with me? I can almost hear her voice. This is your adventure. Take it! Is that it? An adventure, right when I'm in no need of one? I look out the window. A dragonfly is dancing past the glass. That evening, I hand the letter to Jeremy, who reads it once and then starts over and reads it again. He's about to embark on a third reading when I take it out of his hands. He has such a disapproving expression on his face that I feel I should tuck Blix back into the safety of my purse, nestled up between my sunglasses and the little bag that holds my art supplies. So I take it you're planning to go to Brooklyn for this? He says, in the flattest voice anybody ever used. Of course. He's a practical person, and this makes no sense to anybody who didn't know Blix. Well, yes. I've made a reservation for Friday.
Friday.
He sighs. I know what he's thinking. Here we are, in our favorite diner, on an evening when we're supposed to be talking convertibles and beaches and islands, and now we have to deal with this. Decisions that have nothing to do with us. A house that we also never thought about. And a trip, tenants, Brooklyn, freaking New York. Who cares about any of it? And, worst of all for him, I imagine, is the fact that the great aunt of my ex-husband, a man whose name I am apparently not even allowed to say in front of Jeremy, has somehow stepped back into my life, even indirectly. It must feel to him as if Noah himself has just tossed a hand grenade into our relationship.
But how do we know this isn't a scam?
He says.
Maybe there are going to be legal problems, complications. I mean, what are you really walking into? You didn't know her.
I stir my glass of iced tea. It's not a scam. And I did know her.
She didn't even have your new address,
he points out.
How close could you have been?
That's more my fault than hers. I haven't kept in touch. I didn't know she was actively dying, or I would have. She left me this building as a good thing, a nice gesture. It's not a punishment. He's smiling.
Okay, maybe I'm missing something, but I still don't see why she wouldn't leave her property to her family. Isn't that what people do? No offense, but why give it to her grandnephew's ex-wife?
Well, I think she liked me.
I shrug.
He eats more of his hamburger and then pushes his plate away.
Also, we were planning such a fun trip. I thought you wanted to drive up the coast with me.
I do, I say. And we will when I get back. But first I have to go to Brooklyn and see about the building. I finish off two of his French fries. At the booth across from us, a man and woman are on a first date, and without even paying attention to what they're saying, I almost feel the need to go over and tell them that they are perfect together. The air around their booth shimmers a little. I'm startled to realize that this is the first time in so long that I've noticed anybody falling in love, that I've seen sparkles.
You're not going to want to live in Brooklyn, are you? Because I do not see myself as a city guy, and I didn't think you wanted that either.
He laughs a short little laugh. Jeremy, don't be ridiculous. Nobody's talking about moving to Brooklyn. I'm going to look at the building, most likely put it on the market, and come right back. You know, I lean forward and lower my voice. This could be really good for me. I could sell it and get some money, and that could give me a fresh start here. Some money for a house here, you know?
Okay, he says.
His face softens a little, goes back to its non-paranoid state.
Well, so listen.
He swallows.
Along those same lines. I've been thinking about this, and I really didn't prepare any speech or anything, but...
He reaches for my hand across the table, nearly knocking over the ketchup bottle.
But, well, when you come back and everything, what would you think about us getting engaged? I know it's soon and all.
His face is so full of fear and trepidation that it stops my heart.
Oh, Jeremy, really? Are you serious?
He blanches as if I've just turned him down.
Well, I don't know. It just seemed like everything is going in the right direction, and I just thought maybe...
But then he has to stop talking because I am coming over to his side of the booth, and when I get there, I put my mouth on his, hard. He tastes like salt and fries and hamburger. When I finally let go of him, my heart is hammering away, and his face is shining, and he's smiling so big. And I see my life figured out, just as I'd hoped, gloriously unfolding like a movie in front of me. We'll work together every day in his office, and we'll come home together weeknights to our own place, kick off our shoes, put music on, smile when we cook dinner together. And on weekends, we'll go biking and eat brunch with my family, and I'll tend to his mother, and he'll drink beers with my father and Brian. And wow, it's a whole built-in secure life, and all I have to say is yes. So I say it. Yes! He's laughing as I keep my arms around his neck, kissing him on both cheeks. Holy shit, he says. He kisses my nose and my eyelashes. And finally, I settle down and go back over to my side of the booth, and he mops his forehead, grinning at me, and he says,
I did not expect that kind of reaction. Whew!
Then, after we sit and smile at each other for a while, basking in this new decision, he says,
So, you'll go to Brooklyn, and then when you come back, what do you say we tell our families we're getting married, and then we'll find a place, move in together, give it the old trial run?
Okay, yes, the old trial run. I can't seem to stop myself.
So, are we engaged? We're engaged. Is that what this means?
I think it means we're engaged, I say. This is how it happens.
Wow,
he says.
Who knew it was that easy?
It is so very, very easy when it's right. I sit there smiling and holding his hand, and the one thing I know for sure is that everything is going to be all right. 20. Marnie. My family is not at all pleased to hear about my newfound building in Brooklyn or my trip there. They're so upset that I don't even tell them the part that would make them happy, that Jeremy and I are now engaged. Instead, I just listen as they point out that I don't know anything about real estate, that I haven't ever even seen Brooklyn, that this bequeathment is from a woman who at best had shown herself to be a possible crackpot. This was from Natalie, who saw Blix's mind meld while we were waiting for Noah to arrive for the wedding. And at worst, was a psychopathic meddler who is trying to involve innocent people in her shadowy real estate deals. This from my father, who said he knows the ways of the world. But I stand my ground with them, and here I am, 3 days later, landing at JFK International Airport, waiting for a shuttle to take me to the subway, then trying to use an app on my phone to figure out which subway would get me to Park Slope, Brooklyn. Apparently, I am supposed to find Grand Army Plaza, which I will totally do. I can do this city thing when I have to. I have been to San Francisco many times, thank you very much, so I can certainly find my way around a city that has a grid and no crazy hills. My mother keeps texting me. Did you land yet? Are you keeping safe? Do not ride the subway. My friend Helen Brown says it's very dangerous. Alas, the shuttle never comes, and a woman in a brown coat, juggling a toddler and a baby, tells me that I don't want to take the subway from the airport anyway. You'll be on there forever, trust me. You should go stand on the taxi line instead. So that's where I go, and sure enough, all the New Yorkers there seem to be also heading to Brooklyn. Led by a man in a black knit cap who seems to be part of a comedy team and who makes jokes out of the side of his mouth in a gravelly voice, they're all having fun complaining about the slow service, the fact that it's starting to rain, and also arguing about whether or not the Mets are going to win the World Series. A woman with a blue streak in her hair lines up behind me, bumping into my arm as she juggles her suitcase, then shoots me a brief apologetic smile. Just then, my mom sends a screaming text, all in capital letters. Oh, God! Watching the news, somebody got stabbed in a club last night in NYC. Do not go to any clubs! I turn off my phone quickly and put it back in my coat pocket. And then I do the little concentrating thing I do, the thing that makes stoplights turn green and taxis show up. And suddenly, it's my turn for a cab.
It works everywhere.
Brooklyn, just like San Francisco, is so overcrowded that the cab is forced to meander its way in traffic inch by inch. The driver is practically comatose with indifference, and finally, after he has had to slam on his brakes for 3 bicycles, as well as swerve around another car that suddenly just parks in the middle of the too narrow street, he drops me off at the address I gave him and tells me that I owe him $87. He seems quite serious about it, which is so ridiculous that I can't think of anything to do except pay it. He says thank you, helps me with my suitcase, and then drives off. For a moment, I stand, dazed, on the sidewalk, looking around me. Supposedly, I'm at the law office of Brockman, Wyatt, and Sanford, but the only signs visible are for City Nails, Mani-Pedis are $25, a good price, and Brooklyn Burger, now with gluten-free buns. The whole street smells like hamburgers cooking, along with a load of garbage festering near the curb, and the strong perfume of an angry-faced woman who race-walks herself right into me without even bothering to say excuse me. I square my shoulders and go inside a dingy little hallway. The directory sign is missing all the A's, but apparently I'm to go to the 4th floor to see Brockman, Wart, and Sanford. When the elevator door creaks open, there's a magenta-haired receptionist in a black dress who buzzes me in, looking annoyed as hell. A little sign in front of her says her name is LaRue Bennett. I give her my best Florida smile. Hello, I'm Marnie McGraw, and I'm... What? She peers at me. I see that she has a tattoo of a rose on her wrist. I begin again. I'm Marnie McGraw, and I'm here to pick up the keys to Blix Holiday's apartment, or house, or whatever. Blix Holiday? Do you have any ID? Oh, sure. I put down my suitcase and open my purse, which is filled with my boarding pass and my package of gum and my hairbrush and, well, everything except my wallet, which seems to have disappeared. I channel my mother and go immediately into panic mode. The wicked New Yorkers have already stolen my wallet. But then after I've emptied everything onto the counter, with LaRue Bennett watching me, I remember that I put my wallet back in my pocket when I got out of the cab. Sweat is starting to trickle down between my breasts by the time I get out my ID and hand it to her, and she lets out a sigh. Possibly she was on the side of the wallet being gone forever. She looks it over and then pushes it back to me. Okay, well, Charles isn't here. He's gone for the weekend. Back Monday. Oh, I say. Oh. I shift my weight to my other foot. Well, I just flew in from Florida. He said I should get here as soon as possible. I've apparently inherited Blix Holiday's house, and I'm supposed to make arrangements, I guess. But he's gone. Can you reach him? I mean, I was hoping maybe I could at least get the key to the house. I'm to stay there, I think. Her face is impassive. There are stipulations to the will he needs to talk to you about first. Stipulations? Oh, yes. Apparently, Blix didn't just do a straight blah, blah, blah. She did things her own way. Blah, blah, blah. Not until Monday. I can see LaRue Bennett's mouth moving, but my brain has suddenly gotten all staticky. Did I really and truly think that I had somehow managed to outrun my usual luck and that I had seriously inherited a building in Brooklyn, New York? Of course there are stipulations. I am the biggest idiot there ever was, falling for this kind of thing again and again throughout my whole life. Thinking Noah was really going to marry me? Thinking it was my turn to be Mary in the Christmas pageant? Even thinking that Brad Whitaker was going to take me to the prom? And, of course, the stipulations are going to turn out to be that Blix didn't leave me the house after all, which, now that I think of it, is totally fine with me. I just wish I had known before I paid airfare and then taxi fare of nearly $90 plus tip to get to a place that smells like garbage and hamburgers. She probably meant to leave the house to Noah anyway, but he was married to me when she wrote the will, so my name got put on it by accident. Probably happens all the time. "What am I supposed to do next?" I say, looking around the room and starting to panic just the slightest, tiniest amount. Maybe I should forget this whole thing and simply go back to the airport and get a flight back to Florida. Go back to that diner, have another shake and fries, and pretend this never happened. Later this year, I'll marry Jeremy and have a baby. LaRue sighs. "I'll try to reach Charles and see what he can do for you. Go sit." The chairs actually do look good. Beige upholstered armchairs with a Queen Anne table between them. Magazines about architecture. Botanical paintings on the wall. I make my way over to the nearest chair and collapse into it as LaRue disappears into the inner sanctum. My phone dings.
"Hope you're not on your way to becoming a Brooklyn hipster. LOL.
Jeremy. "Yeah, my clothing turned all black the minute I crossed into Brooklyn." After what feels like forever, LaRue returns with the news that she reached Charles and he'd authorized her to give me the key.
"There's a letter, too, but he says he wants to be with you for that. He'll meet with you Monday morning and go over all the details then. Can you be here at 10 a.m.?
"Okay." I get to my feet and take the manila envelope she offers with a ring of keys jingling inside. Outside, I hear sirens coming closer and closer, and the bleating of horns, the squealing of brakes, hot, spoiled city noises. I wish I were back at home, floating in my sister's pool, listening to the hum of lawnmowers. 21. Marnie.
"This is it,"
says the cab driver who is taking me to Blix's building. We've been in stop-and-go traffic on a huge, busy avenue for quite a while, passing everything from ridiculously pricey boutiques to a giant natural food store, little restaurants and cafes with handwritten signs in the windows advertising matcha tea and kale smoothies. But after a while, he turns onto a leafy side street and scoots over to the curb to let me out. I'm in front of a series of towering brownstones all jammed together and hovering near the street, with wide staircases leading up to the landings. So, this is where Blix lived. I take a deep breath and look down at the address written on a piece of paper that LaRue Bennett gave me. Blix's building appears a little worn out, frankly, with rusty-looking wind chimes hanging off the peaked roof over her door and some ragged Tibetan prayer flags clinging to the railing. Next door, which is closer than you might think, an older woman is sitting on the stoop, drinking a can of Coke and watching me.
"Are you lost?"
she calls out to me.
"Not really. I mean, I don't think so. I think this is the place I'm looking for."
She stands up. She must be in her 60s or 70s, but she's wearing yoga pants and a sweatshirt that says Free Tibet and red tennis shoes, and her gray hair is all nestled in curls around her face like anybody's sweet old grandmother.
"Are you Marnie, by any chance?"
"I am."
"Oh, for goodness sakes! Marnie McGraw, I've been expecting you. I'm Lola, Lola Dunleavy."
She comes sprinting down the cement steps and over to me and holds out her arms to hug me.
"Lola, yes," I say, dimly remembering Blix talking about her friend who lived next door.
"You are exactly who I pictured,"
she says. Her eyes, in their nest of lines, are shiny. She grasps my hand and looks as if she might burst into tears.
"You're probably tired and just off the plane, so I should stop talking to you and let you get inside. But, oh, honey, it was so sad, her passing. I still can't get over it. Although, I have to say, she did it her own way. If you've got to pass, and Evidently, it was time. Nobody does it with more flair than Blix Holiday.
She pauses for a moment and closes her eyes briefly, then lowers her voice, leans in.
So, do you know everything that's going on? I mean, did you get the lay of the land?
When she says lay of the land, her eyebrows go up into a little peak.
I think so. I mean, I got the keys.
I drag my eyes away from her and reach inside my coat pocket.
From the attorney's office? Oh, good. I mean, I would have given them to you myself, but I guess we're doing things all official now. Although,
she glances up toward the house, gestures at it like it might be overhearing us.
I don't really know what exactly is going on. I mean, at the moment.
No, I agree. No one seems to.
So, maybe I should leave you alone, and you can go in and figure things out.
Or do you want company?
Well, I guess I'll just unlock the door, maybe, and go in.
Okay, she says brightly.
And then, if you need anything later, well, you can always call me. I might be able to cast a little light if...
Sure. She follows me up the steps.
Blix never did like to use the newer lock, she says. She didn't like locks at all, actually. I was always coming over and finding the place wide open. One time, the UPS guy came by. I think it was UPS. And he opened the door and called out her name, and she sings out, "It's okay! Come in! I'm in the bathtub!" That was our Blix.
The door does not open when I turn the key. I look through the ring of keys I have and start trying different ones. Some don't go in at all. Others go in but stay stuck in place. There's a noise from inside, footsteps walking toward the door.
Oh, dear,
says Lola in a low voice.
So he is here. Now we've probably disturbed him.
Him?
You don't know, do you?
She leans closer to me and cups her hand.
Noah is here.
Noah? Just then, the door flies open, and damned if Noah isn't standing right in front of me, looking from me to Lola with shock on his face, although it would be hard to guess who's more shocked, me or him. I feel my knees wobbling just the slightest bit.
Marnie? What the hell are you doing here, girl?
He's smiling, his eyes crinkled up into little slits. I cannot seem to find words, so I simply stare at him like he's a mirage. He's wearing jeans and a black sweatshirt and holding a bottle of beer and a guitar, of course. This is going to ruin everything. Everything. All of my recovery. All of it.
I could ask you the same thing, I managed to say. What are you doing here? Aren't you supposed to be in Africa?
Just then Lola, who turns out not to be the bravest human on the planet, touches my arm and says softly that she might have something boiling over on the stove and she'll be available later in case I need her. I hear her saying,
"Oh dear, oh dear, oh dear,"
as she heads to her own house. And then I look back at Noah, who is smiling at me like the proverbial cat who is about to swallow the canary.
"It's so good to see you," he says. "I'm afraid, though, that if you've come to see my Aunt Blix, you're too late. But maybe you know that already?"
"I do," I say softly, putting down my suitcase.
"I was so sorry to hear."
He is rambling on and on. Blah, blah, blah. He wants to know why I'm there and not in Burlingame, and I tell him that I've actually been living back in Jacksonville for a while now, which he could have known if he'd so much as even looked at my Facebook feed. I mean, who doesn't do that with an ex? I would know everything about him if he ever bothered to post anything. The last time he posted, it was to say that the African sun is hot, and that was right after he left. So he goes on, and I'm frankly having an out-of-body experience. How is it that just the day before I was safe and in love and getting engaged again, and now I am standing on some steps in Brooklyn looking into the face of Noah. Noah, whom I now realize I have missed, and still miss, with a desperation beyond all reason, which is a horrifying thing to realize. Meanwhile, he's kept talking, and now, from the way he's staring at me, it's apparent that he's asked me a question that he's waiting for the answer to. I review the last few seconds of the tape in my head and realize he wants to know why I am living in Jacksonville. Complicated reasons involving certain financial obligations of an overpriced apartment, I believe, I say. But you had 3 months. I paid my portion of the rent for 3 months. Yes, but as you may be aware, those months ran out. I am smiling.
Yes, and then you were supposed to find a roommate.
Well, I didn't. Do you really want to stand here in the doorway and discuss the problematic roommate situation in Northern California? Or may I come in?
Of course,
he says, stepping aside and flattening himself against the wall so I can get past him. When I brush against him, several of my more alert cells notice that he's something we all once liked. They have conveniently and traitorously forgotten that we are not Team Noah anymore. We are Team Jeremy.
You brought a suitcase, so I guess that means what, that you're planning to stay? I get to enjoy your company for more than just an afternoon?
For a few days, I thought.
That's wonderful, he says. If I'd known you were coming...
Well, I couldn't very well let you know when I didn't even know you were here.
No. I'm not saying you should have. It's just a surprise is all. A very nice... Wonderful, amazing surprise. Here, go through that door,
he says, motioning with his head.
Blix has the first and second floors.
I feel like I have jet lag, even though technically I'm still in the same time zone. Maybe I've somehow gone into a kind of weird time warp. As we go into Blix's living room, I'm struck by the parquet oak floors, the exposed brick walls, the light from the bay windows, the art everywhere. It's beautiful, in a run-down, funky, Blix-ish way. I exclaim over it, and he says,
You want the tour? You've never been in a Brooklyn brownstone before, have you?
I'd love a tour. He keeps stealing little looks at me as he shows me around her apartment. The living room and 2 bedrooms are on the first floor, and the large eat-in kitchen is upstairs, along with a study and a hallway and staircase leading to the roof. Also off that hallway, he tells me, is another 2-bedroom apartment. A woman lives there with her son, he says. She's quite attractive. Amazing curly hair, nice body. He always has to comment on women's bodies, because, he says, that's what life is about, noticing the beauty around you.
There's also a guy in the basement, he says, sort of a recluse, something wrong with his hands and face. Blix collected characters, you know.
He tilts his head charmingly.
Perhaps, now that I think of it, you were even one of them.
Was I? There's so much light in here, I say. The kitchen is astonishing, with 2 huge windows looking out onto all of Brooklyn, buildings, rooftop gardens, condominiums under construction blocks away. Outside, I hear sirens, crashing sounds, voices, car horns.
So, want to go up on the roof?
He says.
We could grab a beer or something, and then maybe you can finally manage to explain why you're here to see my old auntie, who happens to be dead.
And you can tell me why you're not still on your year-long stint in Africa.
Oh, well... Africa. That's a very long, weird story of great bizarreness,
he says, opening the refrigerator. An old model, oval-shaped at the top, and painted turquoise. Everything in this kitchen looks old and worn out and possibly hand-painted. A scarred wooden table in the center, and a countertop that runs along the wall, something that looks like it came from a French country kitchen around the turn of the century. The last century. There's a soapstone sink in the corner and a gas range, little vases with dried weeds and flowers and half-burned candles sitting in saucers on every surface. And the walls are painted a wonderful off-red color with white trim around the windows and cabinets. The floor is worn and scuffed in spots. There are dishes piled in the sink and half-emptied cups of coffee on the table. I have plenty of time to hear it, and the more bizarre, the better, I tell him. He hands me a beer with some unfamiliar Brooklyn label and points the way to the hallway and a steep stairway going up. He pushes the door open at the top, and suddenly we're on an unlikely terrace with planters filled with grasses at one end, surrounding a fire pit and a low table. There's a gas grill pushed over toward the corner and several padded wicker couches, a couple of chaise lounges, and a portable basketball hoop. I have to catch my breath. The view of Brooklyn's skyline is kind of amazing. I can see rooftops all around me with gardens and water tanks, big windows blankly looking back at me, catching the sun. How long have you been here? I say.
I've been here, 3 weeks, maybe?
Were you here when she died?
Yeah, although she would prefer we said when she made her transition.
I didn't even know she was sick. I'm so sorry.
Thank you. Yeah, me neither. Not until I flew in. And then I found out she was dying. She'd been sick for months, maybe even years, without telling. But then once I was here, she wanted me to stay, to see her across, you know.
He opens my beer, and then his own, and puts the opener down on the table.
She was a funny one. Kept things like that a secret, I guess. Didn't want sympathy. Of course, she and I weren't all that close, as you know.
He looks around the rooftop and shakes his head.
She was always just my crazy Aunt Blix. Saying such weird woo-woo stuff it was hard to pay attention to. But you never know, do you? What's going to happen to the people you somehow belong to?
Odd that you, of all people, would be telling that to me. He laughs a little bit through his nose.
Okay, fair enough.
He looks at me for a long moment, and I'm surprised to see how sad his eyes are.
You have every right to be pissed off at me, he says. That was a horrible thing I did to you. And I want you to know that I've kicked myself many times.
I sit down on one of the wicker couches, feeling woozy.
Really? Have you now? Well, let me clarify. I've kicked myself for the way I handled it. So, there we have it. He's not sorry he left. Just sorry for the way it went down. Nice.
He laughs again.
Please, let's don't talk about this. It cannot lead to anything good.
So what happened with Africa? Why aren't you still there? You had to dump Africa too, did you? He grimaces a little at my joke.
Yes, Africa. Well,
he sits down on the couch across from me and starts peeling the label off his beer, the way he always used to do, and launches into a story that involves Whipple signing both of them up to teach music to school children as part of a fellowship he'd gotten. But then, as he puts it, bureaucracy happened. Whipple, in typical fashion, hadn't filed all the papers they needed, and after a long, drawn-out time of bobbing and weaving and trying to go through other channels, finally, they got kicked out of the country.
Same old Whipple bullshit,
he says with a sigh.
Fun, but sketchy. For a month or so, we hid by traveling around, trying to keep from getting deported. But it was touch and go, and then, well, I decided I'd had enough, and, well, I figured I'd come back to the U.S., and I arrived here in Brooklyn just before Blix died. I think he's still backpacking around, trying not to get jailed.
He's silent, picking something off his shoe. Then he looks right at me, and my heart does a little unauthorized flip-flop.
She liked you, didn't she?
He says.
That's why you're here.
I look down, suddenly shy. Yeah, I think she did. She was nice to me.
I know. That horrible party at my mom's, the way she stayed there talking with you the whole time. God, my mom was so pissed that you weren't circulating. Neither of us circulated much, I guess. Did you know that's a guest's job, according to my mom? Apparently you can't just go and have a good time. You have responsibilities.
I think I've heard something along those lines.
Yeah, well, fuck that. I went off and played pool with Whipple because I couldn't take listening to my mom and all her fakey-fake friends. And didn't something else bad happen?
Yeah, the Welsh rarebit situation. He throws back his head and laughs.
Ah, yes! My mom said you wouldn't eat it due to some snobbish thing.
No, I wouldn't eat it due to who knew what the hell it even was. We didn't have such things at Shea McGraw in Jacksonville, Florida. You might have warned me, you know, that there'd be an exam on British culinary practices, but you weren't anywhere around. I had only Blix to defend me.
So that's when it all started,
he says absently.
That's when the whole thing unraveled. Whipple and I were playing pool, and he started telling me about his amazing fellowship and talking me into getting in on the act with him. And I was thinking about the need for one more big adventure. You were talking to my Aunt Blix outside in the snow, as I recall. And everything got set into motion.
That was it?
That was the moment.
So you're saying that if we hadn't gone our separate ways at that party, then we would have just had our regular wedding and you would have stayed with me? Because I have to say, that is absurd and you know it.
Well, who knows for sure?
He says. He looks right into my eyes.
All I want to say is that I did love you, you know. I really thought I wanted to get married.
Until you didn't, I say. And he laughs.
Yeah, until I didn't. My bad.
So, are we to conclude that in the great scheme of things, I lost you but got your great aunt? He puts his hands behind his head and looks up at the sky.
Maybe. Oh, hell. There's a lot I regret, you know, when I think of her. Our family wasn't very good to her. I tried to make it up to her at the end, but we never did really connect in a huge way, no matter how much I tried. She was always, well, you know, crazy.
He pauses. Listen, he says suddenly.
Want to grab some dinner? I haven't eaten anything today but a peanut butter sandwich. I know this sweet little place on 9th that's got amazing burgers and stuff, some local beers, good people. Because as long as we're both here, we might as well have fun, right? No hard feelings for all that bullshit that happened.
I realize I haven't eaten in a long time either. Okay.
Are you really not so angry with me then?
Not so much, I say. I think I'm having an insufficient anger response, actually.
Yeah, you probably should be mad as hell. But I'm glad you're not.
He stands up and stretches, giving me a view of his nice, flat belly and low-slung jeans. It hurts, the deep, long familiarity of him, the badassness of him. And finally, I have to look away. So I take the last drink of my beer and look out at the lights of Brooklyn instead. I am supposed to be here. I am supposed to be here. I take a deep, full breath of the new unknown. I should call Jeremy. I have so many feelings that I'll have to sort out later.
And hey, while we're eating, he says, you can tell me everything that's going on with you and why you serendipitously showed up on Blix's doorstep today.
I guess that's when it really hits me that he probably has no idea that Blix has left me the house. That thought arrives at the back of my neck first and works its way around to the front of my brain, rather like a bug making its way around a nerve-wracking, circuitous path. Just then, the door to the roof bangs open, and a kid who looks to be about 10 years old, with a mop of pale hair and a huge pair of round black plastic glasses, comes charging onto the roof, dribbling a basketball and dancing all around. He leaps up onto the edge of a planter, but he doesn't notice us until he's making his last mental calculation, and when he does, he's so startled that he doesn't quite make the height he needs. The ceramic planter falls over and smashes on the ground, and dirt goes everywhere.
"Sammy, my man, what the heck are you doing?"
Noah says.
"Ah, sorry."
The boy stops and looks instantly horrified.
"Nah, it's okay. It's just a planter. You scared me, that's all."
"I'll clean it up."
"No, go get a broom and dustpan and I'll take care of it. I don't want you to get cut."
Noah turns to me.
"This is Sammy, our resident lovable juvenile delinquent and breaker of pottery. His mom is Jessica, the one I was telling you about. And Sammy, this is Marnie."
Sammy says hi to me and pushes his hair out of his eyes, and then he runs off and comes back with the dustpan and the broom, and Noah and I get to work sweeping up all the shards while Sammy bounces his basketball over in the other corner of the roof. I keep stealing little glances over at him because he's so adorable, like a serious little owl with good dance moves.
"Hey, Noah, guess what?"
he calls after a few minutes.
"My dad's coming to get me tomorrow morning, and we're going to Cooperstown for the weekend."
Noah gives a fake growl.
"What's so great about Cooperstown? You don't care about baseball or anything, do you?"
"Yes, I do. You know I do. And we're going to stay in a B&B and have pancakes for breakfast, and he said maybe there's going to be a pool."
His mom appears just then. She's thin and gorgeous and wearing jeans and a gray cardigan, and she sighs a lot. She looks over at Sammy like any minute he might turn into something that's going to disappear on her. Noah introduces us.
"Jessica, Marnie. Marnie, Jessica."
And she holds out her hand for me to shake.
"Oh, Marnie," she says. "I've heard Blix talk about you. Oh, my goodness, it's so awful what happened. I miss her every single day."
She glances over at Sammy and lowers her voice.
"He does, too. He adored her. There was nobody like her."
Sammy is listening to us talk and dancing over by the fire pit like a goofy bird ready to take flight.
"Sammy, it's bath time, and you need to come in and get your stuff packed up,"
she says. Her eyebrows are all knitted up in a frown.
"Wait, did you break this planter?"
"I didn't mean to."
"It was an accident," says Noah. "No biggie."
But she is clearly worried about Sammy being careless, and now he's destroyed this planter that was Blix's, and those were Houndy's red geraniums planted inside, and everything, she says sadly, seems to be crashing to an end all around them. And right then, my phone starts buzzing in my pocket, and I would be so deliriously happy to be able to escape from this conversation, except that when I look down at my phone, I see the faces of all my family members grinning and waving. All of them, plus Jeremy, wanting to FaceTime with me. It's as though they're suddenly right there on the rooftop with me. I go tearing inside, down the stairs and into the hall, and skidding into Blix's kitchen before they can see where I am and,
oh God,
who I'm with.
"Hi!"
I say, and there they all are, jockeying for position in front of their little screen. Natalie holding up Amelia, who is blowing bubbles.
"Look, Auntie Marnie, I talks with spit,"
Natalie crows in a baby voice. And my mother and father peeking in from the side, trying to ask me a million questions, all of them at once.
"Where are you right now?"
"Is that really Blix's house? Show me the kitchen."
"Is it old? It looks really old."
Don't even tell me those walls are red.
You look tired, sweetie cakes. Bet you wish you could just come home.
And Jeremy, last of all, smiling so winningly.
Are you having a good time? Do you like the house?
I hear Noah coming down from the roof, and so I dash with the phone downstairs toward the living room and sit down on the floor, as far away from the window as I can get.
Oh, yes, it's lovely,
I say to Jeremy, and if my face is turning ashen or bright red, either one, I can only hope he doesn't see in the dim light of the living room. From the kitchen, I hear Noah throwing our beer bottles into the recycling bin and whistling.
We just wanted to make sure you're all right. And that you made it in and everything,
says my father.
Also, honey, just so you know, we've had a family meeting, and we've decided to teach Jeremy the quadruple solitaire game tonight.
Yep, I'm in way over my head,
yells Jeremy from off camera.
So how are you, sweetie?
Says my dad.
I'm fine. Nothing much to report as yet.
My mother's face now looms in the phone.
Can you see me, honey?
Yes, Mom.
Yes, I see you just fine. I hear you, too. So, just tell us this much. Are you going to be able to sell that house, do you think?
I look up then to see Noah standing in the doorway of the living room, his arms folded. And if I had thought he looked shocked when I was standing at the front door earlier,
that's nothing compared to how he's looking at me right now.
22. Marnie.
So, here we go.
When I hang up, Noah comes all the way into the living room, walking so deliberately it's as though the floor might be made of pointy little rocks. His eyes are round and bright with shock. He sits down on the floor across from me and shakes his head.
Okay, Marnie, he says slowly. Why don't you tell me what's going on? What are you doing here?
I swallow.
Oh, God. It's so confusing and complicated. I thought you knew what was going on, but, well, apparently your Aunt Blix left me this house when she died.
You didn't know that.
No, I didn't know that. How was I supposed to know that?
He falls back against the couch and rubs his face briskly with both hands.
She left her house. To you. My ex. Oh, my God, I can't believe this.
Then he puts his hands down and stares at me for a long moment.
Why would she do this? To my mom?
I don't know. I'm as shocked as you are.
He gets out his phone and looks at it.
Oh, fuck. I've had the ringer off and there are, let's see, 13 calls from my mom in the last day and a half. And 3 texts saying I've got to call her immediately.
He sighs and puts the phone back in his pocket.
And my mom doesn't believe in texting, so this means she's really desperate. Fuck, fuck, fuck. Fuckity fuck, what am I supposed to do?
Wait, seriously? You don't check your phone?
Correction, I check my phone, but I keep the ringer off, because if I didn't, I'd go crazy from my mother wanting to be in touch with me all the time. Trust me, this is only slightly more calls than I usually get from her. My policy is that I return about every 5th call.
Noah, what if something's ever really wrong?
I'll find out eventually. She's insane, my mom. You know that.
After a moment, he says,
before I call her, could you please walk me through this? How did this all happen? Did you talk to Blix?
No, I got a letter from a law firm.
A letter? I'm going to need to know more than that now, aren't I? What did the letter say, Marnie?
Just that I had been left this piece of property in Brooklyn, and that I should come as soon as possible because there were some things that needed doing. Some decisions.
Some decisions?
Yes.
And what kind of decisions?
Noah, I don't know what kind of decisions.
stipulations, I guess. Things I need to know about or do or something. That's why I'm here. It said I should come as soon as possible. He doesn't say anything for a long time after that, simply stares off into space. He's flicking his thumb against his index finger.